centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex.
It was a stunning case that ultimately revealed the secretly perverse lifestyle Wesson had forced his family to lead.
It was more like an organized crime family.
According to Yahweh's law, that was just the way it was supposed to be.
One verse that said, if you don't like him, kill him. I really wish I could find him.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. How are you, lovely humans? You hanging in there? You living, you loving, you doing the best you mother effing can during the times when things are getting weird again? But let's not talk about the pandemic. Let's talk about the fact that I'm so grateful that you guys listen to this show. And I have an exciting announcement for you. Well, exciting is putting it in the category of I'm happy it happened, which I'm 100% not. But I am honored and invested with my whole heart in finding justice for a priest whose family and friends reached out to me to help expose and solve the case of his death that, while initially ruled a suicide, was in fact likely one of the shadiest cover-ups in Catholic Church history. You see, Father Joe was days away from reporting the nefarious activities of his colleagues, but he was never able to make it to that meeting. Found with two gunshot wounds to the left side of his head and the files he was planning to expose missing, this true story of his mysterious death will take us into the dark shadows of the church and the story of a priest who risked his life to expose it. So very soon, I will be announcing the air date of a new podcast we are working on with the friends and family of Father Joe to expose the deadly diocese of Buffalo, New York. More to come on that soon. Okay, but today we are diving deeper on part 3 of the Franklin scandal, and eventually in future episodes in the series, the connections it had to similar cases of abuse and possibly murder. Trigger warning. This episode contains depictions of child sexual exploitation, abuse, grooming, violence, religious abuse, substance misuse disorder, and more. Please take care when listening. Like I said last week, it's a lot, but it's important, and I'm determined to bring it to the light of the day, just as John DeCamp, Nick Bryant, and Garrig Caradori had. These investigators and journalists, as well as many social service workers, advocated for these victims against all odds, yet were ignored and threatened. But that can be quite hard when, you know, the FBI, Secret Service, and high-level politicians are involved. This was the late 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And while infuriating, it seems all too common that people with money and power get away with a lot of shady shit. And this is all far before where we stand today in 2021, when finally someone like Prince Andrew might be held accountable for his actions as he is being sued by Virginia Giuffre for the abuse she suffered as a teen at allegedly the hands of Prince Andrew. I believe her, though. And when it happened over two decades ago, she was never given the respect, protection, and justification from the law to hold him accountable. It's all just too similar to the Franklin scandal, a child exploitation ring that I'm convinced is one of the scariest stories of abuse I've ever heard, where these victims were silenced, slandered, and even put in prison for trying to stand up for themselves. And the ones that never got a chance to stand up for themselves have lived through decades of unresolved trauma and heartache. Talented, kind, athletic, beautiful, smart, innocent kids robbed of the futures they should have had been able to explore. When we left off last week, we ended with the plane crash that killed Gary Caradori and his son AJ. A plane crash that many believed was an orchestrated murder to stop his investigation of the Franklin scandal. During the last episode, which was part 2, I also teased that part 3 would begin to discuss the male victims in Boys Town, Nebraska, and its connection to Larry King and his friends who exploited children. I know it can be hard to follow a story through multiple podcast episodes, so I'm going to do my best to simplify and list out perpetrators and victims at the top of each episode. You'll be reminded of or hear their actual bios later, but to make it easier, I'm going to just give you a list of names and separate them into one category, which is scumbag, which is a well-known and corroborated perpetrator, and then victim. Okay, names you already know. Larry King, scumbag, center of this ring and Republican politician who somehow managed to leverage his $17,000 a year salary as the head of the Franklin Credit Union, a floundering bank in Omaha, into flying on private jets, owning multiple homes, driving several expensive cars, and having several kept sexual slaves. So now, new names in this episode. Father James Kelly, scumbag, priest and employee at Boys Town. Leslie Collins, scumbag, and quote-unquote counselor at Boys Town. And then the victims this episode. By the way, all children will be referred to as victims, and even if they did some terrible things to other children, they were kids at the time, all being forced by the adults to do these horrific things. So they are victims. This episode will include the stories of David Hill, victim, Tony Harris, victim, Nikolai Kamen, victim, and Rue Fox, victim. Many more names will come up as the story goes on, but I hope that that helps, and I hope I don't regret taking such a hard stance on labels, but so be it. All right, now finally enter the religious aspect of this story. Boys Town, Nebraska, the fabled Mecca of Holiness. Boys Town was established over 100 years ago in 1917 by Father Edward Flanagan, a young Irish priest born in rural Ireland who made his way to Nebraska and began to work with the homeless. By all accounts, he seems like a good guy. He intended to do charitable things, lived an honest life, and would probably roll over in his grave knowing what the likes of Larry King and his buddies did on his sacred ground. Father Flanagan first worked with homeless men in Omaha, Nebraska, opening a facility called Working Men's Hotel for the homeless and jobless. But then he noticed that there were homeless young boys in need of aid hanging around the hotel. So as the story goes, Flanagan borrowed a mere $90 to pay rent for a boarding house that would eventually become Father Flanagan's home for the boys. The home welcomed boys of all races and religions, and by that following spring, 100 boys were living in the home. In 1921, Father Flanagan purchased Overlook Farm in rural Omaha and moved the boys' home there, calling it the Village of Boys Town. Over the next decade, hundreds of boys called the Village of Boys Town home, and it had grown to include not just a school, but dormitories and an administration building. Students elected their own government, which consisted of a mayor, council, and commissioners. In 1936, the community was recognized as an official village in Nebraska with its own zip code, post office, and police force. All of this because of a simple dream that every child deserves to be valued and loved and deserves to live a healthy and positive life. Sounds idyllic, doesn't it? I mean, even Hollywood took notice. Flanagan's vision was showcased in the 1938 film Boys Town, starring Mickey Rooney and Spencer Tracy. Tracy even won an Academy Award for his portrayal of Father Flanagan, which he later gave to the priest. President Truman even asked Flanagan to take his vision and message to the world. After World War II, he traveled the globe visiting those orphaned by war and advised government leaders on how best to care for them. And Boys Town still exists today, though it has obviously changed as it has grown immensely. But according to their website, Boys Town provides, quote, an array of life-changing youth care and health care services that meet each child and family exactly where they are, so they get the right kind of care at the right time in the right way, end quote. More than just a mere brick-and-mortar location aimed at rehabilitating and redeeming troubled kids, instead of incarcerating and punishing them, the facilities span from the headquarters, village of Boys Town in Nebraska, to Florida, Louisiana, Iowa, New England, Nevada, and even Washington, D.C. The organization continues to seek to advocate for reform and juvenile justice. Good. It seems they have come a long way from the experiences of the students we are about to discuss in the 1980s and 1990s. But if we've learned anything, it's that appearances can be deceiving. Hey, ladies. Well, and guys, you should listen to this too. Hey, having a period's not a big deal. It happens every month. Not a big deal. But you know what's frustrating? Is previous period care. But you know what changes that? Flex. If you want a period product that looks out for your body, your lifestyle, and the planet, you have got to try Flex. I am a huge believer in them. Flex is innovating period care with products that are body safe, made for comfort, and made to keep you moving. There's the Flex Disc, which is a one-time use menstrual disc that fits perfectly inside your body. I personally, listen, I've changed my whole period regimen around the Flex one-time disc. It's pretty much amazing. The one Flex disc can be worn for up to 12 hours and holds as much flow as 3 super tampons. It's not a cup, and it's better than a tampon. It's unlike any other period product you've seen before. Trust me. Plus, you can wear it for mess-free period sex. Your white sheets will thank you. Flex discs also create 60% less waste compared to pads and tampons. So yeah, you can consider Flex like your environmental good deed. And if you want to go zero waste and have the planet love you, pick up the Flex Cup, a reusable menstrual cup that Cosmo rated number one. The patented pull tab makes Flex the only cup on the market that removes like a tampon. It's so easy and you already know how to use it. It's disability friendly and made with beginners in mind. It's velvety soft and completely body safe, and it lasts for years. They also have helpful videos, in-depth diagrams, GIFs, and Flexperts available to walk you through the entire process. You're never going to go back to other products from, you know, let's just not talk about the tampons that we used to use. You're not going to go back to them once you try Flex. So say goodbye to cramps, put sex back on the table, and lend Mother Nature a hand. Go to flexfits.com/sinners and use code sinners for 20% off Flex Disc Starter Kits or 10% off your first Flex Cup, plus U.S. shipping free. That's code sinners at flexfits.com/sinners. FLEXFITS.com/sinners. SINNERS. Private investigator hired by the Franklin Committee, Gary Caradori, compiled a list he deemed, quote, the leads list, which I was actually able to obtain online, and it's expansive and fascinating. The list includes various perpetrators and victims, sources, and corroborating facts. Nick Bryant, author of the Franklin scandal, was able to speak to a few of the victims from Boys Town. I have also attempted to locate them myself, and I'm still working on it, but it's been over 10 years since Nick tracked them down, and he had a very difficult time when he wrote his book in 2009. The first man he spoke to was David Hill. David had been living between his girlfriend's house, his parents' home, and sometimes on the street. Despite what could be considered flaws to some, I think that David seems like a very endearing person. The way Nick describes him and the time he spent with him, David Hill was a talker. He could speak to anyone. He loved fast food and was actually shocked when Nick wanted to eat fresh fruit over a Burger King Whopper. David Hill also had stellar athletic abilities in his youth and even scored 2 touchdowns in a game when he was just a second stringer after replacing the first string player that game at Boys Town. It was a big win for the kid. Recalling this memory while flipping through a Boys Town yearbook was the first time David smiled. David had two stints at Boys Town. One from 1979 to 1981, and one from 1983 to 1985. But he was ultimately kicked out because of drug use. Later in life, he became addicted to crack and did time for armed robbery of a pizza delivery man. His drug addictions were his way to cope with his pain. Though he had fading memories of the good times he had at Boys Town, he was also harboring a terrible secret. Initially, David was reluctant to discuss the abuse he suffered at Boys Town, but after a few fast food meals and some time spent cultivating his trust, David Hill eventually opened up to journalist Nick Bryant, and the two formed a friendship of sorts. Bryant presented David with the leads list, and David said he recognized many names on it. Then he told Bryant of his first abuse on the Boys Town campus. Hill said he was molested by an older student at the age of 13 during his first year at Boys Town. This student had a managerial position in the house where David lived, and David said they had sex on multiple occasions. This allowed David to have privileges, though not given to other students, and this would become a Boys Town theme. You see, Larry King, the abusers in his circle, and abusers in authority at the campus, would use the kids for sex in exchange for money or extra privileges. However, this abuse caused David so much mental anguish that he eventually opened up to his family teachers about what had happened. Family Teachers, by the way, was a program implemented where students would live with a husband and wife team who would care for them. The Family Teachers became part of the Boys Town system. Anyway, when David Hill opened up to his family teachers about his abuse, they then referred him to a priest named Father James Kelly for counsel. Father James Kelly then molested him. I was able to find corroboration for Father Kelly's alleged abuse of several other Boys Town students. Publicly, Father Kelly denies it. However, with various accusations from several boys who did not know each other, I believe David Hill and the other men who came forward. News articles will be linked in the show notes with the corroboration. After their first meeting, David Hill couldn't sleep and he phoned Nick in the middle of the night. He said he had suppressed his sexual abuse for so long and he had used drugs to stuff it down and cope, and then finally talking about it caused him so much inner turmoil that he could not rest. Sadly, what brings these kids to Boys Town? Early family situations, sometimes abuse, parents who are mentally or physically unable to care for their kids, makes them more vulnerable to abuse at a place like Boys Town. Though David Hill denied any involvement with Larry King, he said he knew people that were abused by King. He then helped Nick Bryant contact the names on the leads list that he recognized. Side note. I hope very much that David Hill eventually pulled out of his cycle of substance abuse and got the help he needed to recover. He seems like a nice guy. So, David Hill then helped Nick get in touch with Tony Harris, a man he knew on the leads list. And eventually, Bryant and Hill together drove to Kansas City to meet with Tony Harris. Tony Harris had attended Boys Town in the late 70s and early 80s. He graduated in 1981. While at Boys Town, he was an all-star running back and a sprinter for track. But he was also a victim of Larry King and his circle. His potential floundered as a result. When Nick and David caught up with him, they arrived to his home where he lived with his girlfriend and proudly displayed photos and accolades of his children. According to Nick Bryant's book, he described Tony as, quote, "The 40-year-old Harris was a trim 6'2". He wore a white t-shirt tucked into his blue jeans. Harris had the looks and physique of a top-notch male model who had aged gracefully." David and Tony caught up and got comfortable as Nick initially watched on, but then it was time for Tony to share his story. Nick suggested that David exit the room in case, you know, Tony felt too uncomfortable to share his experience in front of him, so David did. Then his story began. Tony told Nick that he was recruited by other students into Larry King's circle. During his 4 years at Boys Town, He was flown to Washington, D.C. with Larry King numerous times. On his first trip, the student who plucked him into joining said participation was optional. And though he didn't participate that first time, King gave him money and promised him far more if he, quote-unquote, participated in the future. On the next trip, he did give in to sexual activity and continued to over the next few years. Tony told Nick Bryant the only place he would fly was Washington, D.C., but he had the opportunity to fly to other places. He said between 5 to 10 kids would be on a chartered flight at any given time, and about half the kids would be Boys Town students. And I do not say kids lightly. There were literal prepubescent children abused in this ring. Back to Tony. He said, quote, the gatherings would be held in people's homes or hotel suites. The men there would want things done to them sexually, or they would want to do things to me sexually. The minimum I would get was $100, but I could get up to $500, end quote. He said the men were all high-level, high-society looking. They wore tailored suits, clean cut. He said they would pick their prey by having a conversation with you or simply looking you up and down. But it seemed that the men and King already had an arrangement, and anything beyond that was up to the men. Sometimes the men also offered additional gratuity. Tony flew to D.C. about once a month, and he declined occasionally because of athletics. Simply put, if he needed money, he knew where to go. Drugs were also par for the course. Drugs and parties went hand in hand, and he said the older men particularly loved cocaine. You might be asking yourself, how is it possible that students could just up and leave campus for a whole weekend? Apparently it wasn't difficult, and it was one of the perks for being associated with King. It seems where the house parents were concerned, it was a don't ask, don't tell sort of policy. Maybe they knew what was going on, maybe they didn't, or maybe they didn't want to. In spite of it all, Tony felt a sort of loyalty to Boys Town. He didn't want to tarnish the Boys Town name and didn't want to blame Boys Town, but expressed that he was shocked that all of this happened to so many boys and it flew under the radar with such ease. He then almost recoiled from disparaging anyone and claimed that he was okay and that the abuse hadn't affected him. He told Nick he had never talked to anyone about his abuse from Larry King and others. But like David Hill, Tony Harris had no motive to divulge their trauma to Nick. I mean, it would almost serve them not to tell a reporter. But sadly, when Nick contacted Tony again months later, he seemed to have descended into drug addiction. Nick suspected crystal meth or crack, and hopefully the recounting of his abuse did not spark a way for him to cope, but such is the case with Franklin and many stories of child abuse. Nick Bryant kept rolling through the leads list, though, attempting to contact more victims in order to validate the story that, in my opinion, had already been validated over and over again at this point, but I understand why he needed the confirmation. Rue Fox was next. At first, Rue seemed intimidating and scary. I mean, he was super muscular and stocky. In addition to that, Nick had been warned that he had a history of violence. But Nick would soon come to find that Rue was a hurt little boy living inside a 36-year-old man. Rue was born in Texas, and his mother died when he was just an infant. Rue moved to Omaha in the late 1970s with his father and older brother. But his father was sent to prison almost immediately upon arrival. So Rue and his brother bounced between foster homes as a result. Finally, at the age of 13, Rue landed at Boys Town. Sadly, at this point, though, he had already been molested by one of his caregivers. So, because of his earlier molestation, Rue was sent for counseling with Leslie Collins, a staff member of Boys Town who had a master's in social work and a PhD from Yale specializing in sexually abused kids. Dr. Leslie Collins even wrote 3 books on how to handle victims of childhood sexual abuse. It was Dr. Collins who then introduced Rue to Larry King. You might be wondering how that is even possible. Where are the boundaries? How could a counselor who advocates for sexually abused children introduce the vulnerable Rue Fox to notorious child predator Larry King? Well, it turns out that Dr. Collins was a scumbag himself. In 1996, Dr. Leslie Collins, buddy of Larry King, was charged with repeatedly molesting his two stepdaughters. A charge he doesn't deny, and a charge I'm going to go into after finishing poor Rue Fox's story and the other final Boys Town victim I'm going to cover in a minute. Listen, I didn't intend to go into Leslie Collins as much as I'm about to at the end of this episode, but I normally review and revise episodes right before I record them, and while doing so, I found Leslie Collins' court documents, which shocked me so much that I'm going to have to share. Now back to Rue. Upon his introduction to Larry King, Rue initially liked him. Larry took Rue to all the popular spots in Omaha, like movie theaters, the mall. But one night, he took Rue to a park and started touching him inappropriately. The molestations happened 10 to 12 times, usually in a park. This was different than the stories from other victims. There were no orgies or chartered planes or satanic rituals. Larry also showed increasing aggression and viciousness toward Rue. And after injuring him during one encounter, it's too graphic for me to say what happened, sorry, Rue refused to have any interactions with Larry after that, and he started acting out. He was eventually sent to the farm at Boys Town and ultimately to a psychiatric ward. Rue has no fond memories of his time at Boys Town, and he sobbed uncontrollably when recounting the carnage of his life to Nick Bryant. Rue had descended into substance misuse disorder, drinking heavily and injecting crystal meth to deal with his pain. Are you like me, and when you get super into a podcast, you just have to know what the people looked like or what the crime scene looked like? Well, now you don't have to do the heavy lifting, because this cool new app called Votacast has done the heavy lifting for you. Votacast is an amazing new immersive podcast app that will allow you to experience this podcast and others in a way you haven't been able to until now. Votacast will provide you a deeper version of the show and allow you to view photos of the people and places we're talking about in this episode. You'll also get links for articles about the case. When you experience a podcast on Votacast, you not only will be listening to your favorite podcast, but you'll be digging into stories that will come alive with supplemental digital content that allows you to have everything being discussed in the episode at your fingertips. I mean, like I said, if you're like me, after you listen to a podcast, you search for more details, photos of the people, events discussed in the episode. With Votacast, it's all right there for you. So try Votacast out today. Click on the link in my show notes to learn more about Votacast or download the app today in the App Store and change the way you experience podcasts forever. That's Votacast, V-O-D-A-C-A-S-T. Nick and Rue stayed in touch, and they met up maybe a year after their first interview. And Nick had suggested to him a rehabilitation facility in the Nebraska area that David Hill had also attended. Rue ended up going, and during their next visit, Nick picked him up to have lunch. During that visit, Nick reported that Rue was a different, healthier version than the person he first met. I'm personally rooting for you, Rue. I also like saying rooting and Rue. And to quote from Nick Bryant's book, which made me cry when I first read it, he states, quote, "As I interviewed Fox, he occasionally broke down in tears. The spite and rancor he wore like a protective suit of body armor dissolved. The ex-con, with a, quote, history of violence that I was warned about, morphed into a damaged boy before my very eyes." Actually, the damaged boy had been there the whole time. I just hadn't noticed him. Almost cried then saying it. Nikolai Kamen was the final person interviewed for Nick Bryant's book concerning Boys Town. Though we will go into the extremely heartbreaking stories of Troy Bonner, Danny King, and Paul Benassi, the most publicly known male victims next episode, we have to close up Boys Town first. And by the way, the videotaped statements of Paul Bonassi and Troy Bonner I was able to find online, and the account of Danny King's statements reported, I could barely get through 15 minutes of it before pretty much screaming into the ether that I was angry for what these poor kids went through. What's crazy, though, is that these men aren't asking for sympathy or trying to make excuses for where their lives are today. They are simply telling their stories. They were kids when it happened, and I personally feel they deserve a ton of sympathy. Regardless, no one has more self-awareness of where his life stands today than Nikolai Kamen. Nikolai Kamen, who was born under the name Andre Payne, a name he changed later after his storied past, he arrived at Boys Town in 1985. Through corresponding with him in a North Carolina federal prison, Nick Bryant learned some of the most damning information about Larry King's parties. Nick had heard of Kamen through John DeCamp, but initially felt almost overwhelmed by the story and its nuances. With the name change and his brothers also being at Boys Town, and then also our prison inmates as well, one's on death row, it just seemed too much to tackle at first. But eventually he wrote Kamen a letter to the North Carolina prison he resided at. Kamen wrote back and was at first hesitant and then completely blunt. He was upset that he had been thrown around as a Larry King victim, though acknowledged that he was. He insinuated that there were many Boys Town students who were victims of abuse. Why his story? Their relationship warmed up a bit, and Nikolai began to open up to Bryant. He said that where his life is now is his own doing, his own actions, and he does not blame others for his problems. But he did have an incredibly rough go. Nick Bryant explained his reasons for contacting Nikolai, that he wanted to expose the Franklin scandal and needed the evidence and corroboration to do so. Nikolai had warmed by this point and explained that he understood why Nick was reaching out to him, but politely said that he didn't want to tell him something he already knew. And this is where his bluntness comes in. He said, quote, "My interaction with Larry King was through child prostitution." And he considered Boys Town as a whole to be a successful failure, end quote. Though he learned social skills and how to treat people, it was at the price of his own soul. Nikolai recalled good, bad, and scary times there, but it was, quote, "the best I was going to get." Nikolai recalled his first month at Boys Town being okay, but he was the youngest student in his house and he wasn't well liked. He ran away to his mother's apartment often, which was close to the Boys Town campus, and he would stay for a day or two and return to Boys Town, but he was eventually barred from seeing her. His mother struggled with mental illness and wasn't able to properly care for him. And this is where things started to change for Nikolai. He began to adopt a complacent attitude and did whatever he pleased. He said he tested the limits to see what he could get away with, and a sort of popularity ensued, actually. He was then moved to another home, one of the best on campus, but things went a bit sideways. He said the mind games started. One minute they liked you and the next they didn't. Manipulation. They would say one thing and do another. They would tell him he could see his mother the next weekend, but then he was never able to again. And they would deny ever giving him that permission. And this is where the story gets a bit confusing and where Nick Bryant believes Nikolai began flying with Larry King. You see, the pretend trips to see his mother were really trips with King. Sure enough, fellow students had hooked Nikolai for King. Nick Bryant maintains that Nikolai gave sound details and seemed very sincere. The student that introduced Nikolai to Larry King's ring said that he could make a lot of money and meet a lot of people and make something of himself. Of course, he was never told what he had to do to make that money. On his first outing, he was taken to the Twin Towers in Omaha, Nebraska, and photographed in the nude. Nikolai was only 11 years old when he started flying with King, hanging around their circle, 11 years old. He says there were always other kids on the flights and there were always drugs involved. Oddly, Nikolai only ever received $50 for being exploited by King. King always told him, quote, I'll get you later. You can have anything you want at Boys Town. He told Nikolai to get whatever clothes or toys he wanted. If he wanted a keyboard, he could have a keyboard. Whatever he needed or wanted, all he had to do was say it. Not ask, but say it. And all he had to do was be subjected to extremely sadistic sexual abuse in exchange. Nikolai also alleges the satanic ritual aspect of his abuse. And like I said last episode, I don't want to go into that because it's so hotly debated these days, and I don't know. But he does have similar allegations that Shanetta Moore, Paul Benassi, and others have regarding the satanic abuse. Nikolai states that the parties he was brought to were insane, outrageous. Orgy after orgy. And he's not the only one that has said that. Nikolai recalled being tortured, beaten, handcuffed, videotaped. He has scars on his body from his flights and experiences with Larry King and his group of friends. And he still has these scars to this day. Scars that more than once have gotten questions from doctors. He, among others, claimed that Larry King was a violent sexual sadist. After one crazy party in 1988, Nikolai realized he couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't keep this to himself, and he told his family teachers about his weekends with Larry King. They didn't protect him. He explained to Nick Bryant that the next morning, out of nowhere after telling him that, he was then put on a plane to Georgia and told he was terminated from Boys Town. He was then committed to a mental ward for 2+ years. The caseworkers in Georgia were actually even surprised, and they were like, we have not been given a reason as to why he was there. With only a couple hours' notice, no one knew why he was there. But after spending over 2 years at the ward, he eventually wrote a letter to Boys Town asking to come back. Why? Well, according to Nikolai, it was still better than the mental hospital, and in his words, probably the best place he had been sent as a child. Nikolai spent his youth at Boys Town, inexplicably in mental facilities, and then eventually prison. Yet he still doesn't blame anyone for his problems, despite acknowledging he was severely abused by King and his group. That just makes my heart hurt. Along with knowing that Nikolai, too, was counseled by our pedophile counselor, Dr. Leslie Collins, expert in childhood sexual abuse, and author of a book titled Say Book, a personal workbook for socially aware youth, printed December 1, 1989, by Boys Town Press. The title of that book confuses me, and I don't really... Socially aware youth, say, S-A-Y. Okay, great. The synopsis of the book says, this workbook provides the youth in a say group with information about sexual abuse and written exercises to help them deal with their feelings about abuse. The material not only supplements the therapist's leader's treatment, but also gives the youth opportunities to uncover and confront their painful past and actively pursue ways to get better. I am going to throw up reading that. Oh my God. And I cannot believe Amazon is still selling it. And the only review on Amazon for this says, please know that the primary author of this book is Leslie Collins. He's been in prison since 1996 for child sexual abuse. Amazon has been informed about this and yet still makes this book available for sale. Do not buy this book. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. 1 out of 5 stars. Might be a good idea to pull the book, Amazon. Just saying. Jeff Bezos, whatever your name is. Just maybe take it off. He's not a good guy. In fact, he's such a bad guy and ran with other bad guys like Larry King that his trial and the documents I found describing it are some of the most bizarre and terrifying I have ever read. Gang, I never promised this was going to be a light story, and I truly apologize for the content, but I'm going to end on a few excerpts from his court documents They are scary. Trigger warning, trigger warning, trigger warning. Okay, so from the court documents of Dr. Leslie Collins, the counselor at Boys Town. Collins is a psychotherapist who specialized in treating victims of sexual abuse. Collins and Rita were married in 1984 and had their own psychotherapy business. Collins also worked at Boys Town, where he helped children with sexual abuse problems. He has written 3 books dealing with sexually abused youths. Rita had 2 children, JC and SC, from a former marriage. JC, born March 3, 1972, and SC, born August 4, 1974, were respectively 12 and 10 at the time of Collins' marriage to Rita. So those are his 2 stepdaughters. Their names are obviously redacted because they were youth. I think they were around like 22 when the court case actually happened. Anyway, so Rita's their real mom. Collins, Dr. Leslie Collins, was their stepdad. All right. These are just small excerpts, but Exhibit 1 reflects that Collins started touching JC inappropriately when she was 12 or 13, and this abuse escalated and eventually progressed into having sexual intercourse twice a week when JC was 17. JC turned 17 in March 1989. Collins stated that intercourse continued until JC ended her relationship with him in late 1994 or early 1995. He's admitting it. The abuse continued through visits and quote-unquote phone sex after she went to Dartmouth College. She stated that on several occasions, she told Collins she wanted to stop or did not want to have sex with him, and that he would become agitated and have long talks with her. On one such occasion, he sat up with her half the night with a knife in his hand and threatened to kill her, stating that nobody would care or know. He also told her that she had nothing to be angry about because he had not raped her, and that if she wanted to have something to be angry about, he would rape her. Collins did not deny any of the abuse. Again, this is all in court documents. In fact, he admits that the abuse occurred over the past decade, essentially as the girls described it. He also describes himself as being very controlling. Collins admitted that he would have one girl wait downstairs to watch for their mother while he was upstairs having sexual intercourse with the other. He admitted asking the girls to photograph their sexual encounters with other persons, even obtaining a camera for them to do so. He admitted to sexual penetration of both girls in 1992. During his abuse of both victims, he assured them that he was just teaching them about proper sexual relationships and how to enjoy their sexuality. The girls felt he kept them under his control even after they left for college because he would call them several times a day, and the sexual abuse occurred whenever they saw him. Then the court states, we're going to end on this. I know it was a lot. We understand that Collins may feel indeed genuine sorrow for these crimes, and that the shame and personal losses resulting from these convictions are significant punishments. Nevertheless, Collins' abuse of these girls is just so bizarre that even those of us who think we have, quote, seen it all, are appalled. And more importantly, Collins' conduct continues to haunt the lives of both JC and SC. Next week's episode is still quite bad, but a tad more political espionage and interesting over just straight up heartbreaking. But it's still not great. Thank you guys so much for listening though and going on this journey with me. And if you're enjoying the show, the best thing you can do is to tell a friend. Leave a 5-star rating and positive review wherever you listen. And I want to give a special shout out to research and writing assistant Kate Codman. Follow her on the social medias. She's at Seattle Caitlin? Seattle Caitlin. She helped me so much in working on this episode particularly, and I'm immensely grateful. It was just so dark. I had a rough time with it, and I am grateful that she helped me write it. So, thank you, Kate. Bye.